Good afternoon. Welcome to Healthy Options on WERU Community Radio. I'm Rhonda Feynman, and our guest today is Heather Ellsworth, musician, singer, composer, and music therapist. Heather Ellsworth became captivated by music from a very early age, and by taking piano lessons, violin lessons, guitar, and drums, it led her to major in music composition in college, where she created and performed rock, pop, new age songs, writing lyrics in four-part harmony. Since that time, she's been composing, singing, and playing music, usually solo, briefly with a reggae band and a funk band. She released a CD in 2008 and continues to offer songs online, typically writing about what she calls lyrically intense comedic songs. Heather went on to obtain a degree in music therapy and since 2018 has been practicing as a board-certified music therapist and a neurological music therapist. And we're very curious what that actually means. So can't wait to get to that. And currently, she works with elementary and middle school children with autism and other developmental disabilities, and also with seniors with dementia. In addition to providing music therapy, she teaches music lessons, music appreciation, and comedy improv to teenagers. Welcome to Healthy Options, Heather Ellsworth. So happy to have you here today to talk with us about the many links between music and health.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So let's start at the beginning. There's just so many avenues here that we need to address. But what's music therapy? What is that? Let's just start with the fundamentals.
So music therapy is the evidence-based use of music interventions to accomplish individualized goals within a therapeutic relationship. And yes, I am reading that because that is the American Music Therapy Association's official definition. So it's basically using music within settings. It could be group or individualized to reach goals that are set by the client or caretakers or the music therapist that will hopefully translate outside the sessions.
So what would be a goal? What would that be? What does that look like?
Yeah, so a goal could be anything as broad as, say, increasing self-confidence to something more specific, like having a more, a steadier gait, say, for someone with Parkinson's.
So why would that work? What is it about music that would be helpful to achieve that kind of goal? I know there's been a lot of talk about how our brains contemplate and take in music. What's your take on it with your experience?
I'm not a neuroscientist, but I know that music encompasses broadly across our brains. You know, we've got the rhythm of music, we've got the melody, we've got the meter. So there's a lot of different parts of our brains that light up when we're listening to or engaged in music. And so when some circuitry is damaged, like say in a stroke or a brain injury, neuroplasticity allows other connections to be made in other parts of the brain so that those functions can come back in a different, like within a slightly altered structures.
So that's so interesting, that sense that music really touches the whole brain. It's not really although these things you mentioned, rhythm, tone, melody are specific, but really it's touching the whole brain. So we could do something with music and help someone's gait. That's that's so interesting and so powerful. Yeah, and you're working with some adults with dementia. How, I think I've read, and you could speak to this, that really hearing and is one of the last things that we still have, even as people are dying. So it seems that whole sense of music and that whole sense of taking things in is something that's with us always. So what are you seeing when you're working with someone with dementia? How are you, are they remembering music? Do they remember a melody or what happens?
Yeah, typically people remember music from their teens and their 20s the most. That's when we have a lot of changes going on in our lives, a lot of intense things, a lot of learning about ourselves. And that might contribute to why those eras get very encoded in our hippocampus. So when I'm working with folks with dementia, I usually focus on music from whatever decade their teens, you know, whatever decades their teens and their 20s were in. And as you probably read, frequently they can be almost nonverbal, but can still sing lyrics from those times. So it's a way of expressing themselves and likely of generating memories, even if they can't verbalize that.
So what are you seeing? You know, what's the affect? How do people perceive when you're singing, you know, an old chestnut from their youth? Give us some of your experiences.
Yeah, I mean, they can really light up. You know, I think it's, besides the fact that having dementia is just a ridiculously hard thing, I think, to bear, there's the aspect of usually, at least the facilities I work in, being away from their families, being in a home that wasn't familiar with them until fairly recently. And so it just seems like all aspects of their life are fairly disorienting. But then they sit down and they hear something that is a strong memory that they can relate to. And they're singing and they're seeing that other people are singing around them. So it becomes kind of a community event as well. They tend to light up and just, you know, they're smiling, and that's great.
And it's changing, I would imagine, hormonal changes. You know, we know that there are calming of the nervous system. What some of the chemicals, what, you know, that we have surging through our body right now? What?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, singing itself releases, can release dopamine and serotonin and endorphins. So even, you know, singing in the shower, singing in the car can be beneficial in that way. I know when my energy is low and I'm driving long distances, I tend to just start singing to increase my mood and my energy. So
are you singing songs of your youth or are you writing? You are a composer. Are you writing new songs as you're going down the highway there?
Well, all of the above. I might be listening to 80s songs in the car. I might be listening to dubstep and making up words to it. I might be trying to come up with lyrics for an intervention with a 7-year-old child, or I might be writing my own wacky comedic songs to perform on stage. But yeah, the car is good for that. Even if it's not good for the environment, it's good for listening to and composing music.
There you go. And of course, we all become better drivers when we're relaxed. And and the serotonin, which is, these are kind of endorphins. These are kind of the calming, helping our nervous system, you know, flooding our bloodstream with things that are calming. Mm-hmm. And it certainly seems that we need that kind of thing now. And I know that you're working with groups, and we've seen, for instance, music be so instrumental in things like the Civil Rights Movement, Bernice Johnson Reagan, who from Sweet Honey in the Rock, and SNCC, which was one of the early civil rights choruses, and they had musical choruses, said that we just sang all the time. What are you seeing on that level with the work that you're doing in the community as well?
Right. Yeah. So in terms of political activism, there is a local group called Audacity, the Audacity, and it is largely based on using different art forms to protest what's happening right now and to fight for human rights. And I am part of the singing component of that. So I'm one of the song leaders. There's several of us. And every Saturday at noon, we are out at Chapman Park in Rockland. And there's some people are there to sing. Some people are there to hold signs. Some people are there playing trumpet and drums. But the singing really, you know, it really gets people in a good mood and very energetic. And we're also more visible to like the cars that are passing by and the people walking on the street if we're making a lot of loud, happy noise.
But yeah, there's so much stress in the world. Mm-hmm. And it seems, you know, whether it's that or if you're listening in your own communities, because we are broadcasting everywhere, WERU. There must be groups to sing with, to help us calm our own nervous systems, to be resilient in ways that we can move forward and feel connected. It's so easy to feel isolated. And what we're learning here from the music therapy, and all of this comes together, is how important that is for our health. So even working with someone who is nonverbal in a therapeutic setting, we take those strategies and we bring it to everybody, whether you're having a brain injury or a diagnosis of some sort that impinges on your functioning in some manner.
Yeah. I mean, the summary is, yes, music can be helpful in so many settings, I think, whether it's one person singing in the shower or, you know, a music therapy group, or using it at political rallies to get momentum and joy up. I think it used to be more naturally part of people's lives. And there's so much stimulation all the time now from media, social media, you know, our lives are so busy that I think we forget that we can forget about music easily.
Let me ask you, when you are, and I know you're working with kids, on the young kids on the autism spectrum, and we're talking about some people with dementia, and you don't have to be elderly. So there are many different age groups where you can have that kind of brain issue. How do you individualize things? I mean, I know we would say, you know, if you're in your 80s, you might want to hear Frank Sinatra. I don't know. Maybe if you're in your 30s, you might want to hear Frank Sinatra or Eliza Gilkison. The point I'm trying to make is, how do you look to see how someone's reacting to, are you playing the music yourself? I know you are a musician, or are you using recordings? How do you work with that and individualize this?
So there's a few different things. I'm playing live music, or I'm letting my clients play music on whatever instrument I'm bringing in to them. Or sometimes when I'm working with seniors in assisted living facilities, I'm playing pre-recorded music while we do movement activities, like throwing and kicking a ball around the room, or doing movement with scarves just to keep limber, you know, keep in motion. There's a lot of sitting going on most of the day there. So some people have the ability to tell me what they want, say in the situation of a group of people in an assisted living home, and some people don't. And so I tend to just, if they don't, I watch for reactions. I watch for whether they're playing the percussion instruments I hand out, whether they're singing, what their expressions are. And if I play a song where the room suddenly becomes quiet and morose, then I don't play that song again. You know, like one time I tried a song from the 80s. Nope, it was just to throw something different in there, knowing that wasn't their generation, but just to see, nope, it wasn't going to fly. And with kids, I work with both like in group settings and individually with kids with either autism or other developmental delays or behavioral issues. And some of those that are verbal will definitely be very vocal about what they want to hear. And interestingly, recently, the elementary kids have been requesting songs from the 80s. So I don't know if they're being covered by modern artists or whether their parents are influencing their musical taste. I'm not sure. But when children have no ability to speak, sometimes their teachers or caretakers or parents will let me know what they've responded positively to in the past, because I'll have an intake form for them to fill out, and I'll know that way, or we'll just experiment. And a lot of those sessions for me it's more engaging than just me playing music. So I'll be trying to have them maybe replicate patterns on chime bars or drums, or they might be engaged in pointing to a song that incorporates pointing to the correct picture, might be incorporate visuals. So it's definitely not always me playing music for them, if you know what I mean.
I do. And we're, well, in a little bit, I think we're going to do a little interactive musical moment. If you have just joined us, this is the Healthy Options Program right here on WERU Community Radio. I'm Rhonda Feynman, and our guest today is Heather Ellsworth, music therapist, neurologic music therapist, musician, singer, and composer. So lots of things going on. We are talking about how music affects our brains and how it can affect kids or adults with some sort of perhaps a disability or some sort of way of intervening to create that connection between the nervous system and brain function. I have a question about what about dissonance? What about melody? Have you noticed, you were saying before that little bit of business that we just did, that some things will be flat. There will be, it's sad or a little bit moody. Now, there obviously we know about the structure of music, and there are different keys that are minor keys can be more ominous or moody, positive, you know, keys can make you feel uplifted. Are you noticing, let me put it this way. There was a someone I know who would get therapeutic massage listening to heavy metal.
Okay.
There, all right. And then, I mean, now, think about that for a minute. And then, so are you noticing how the different types of music are affecting people and how they respond and what that means individually for a client?
Well, I have talked, I remember talking to some clients who, you know, preferred heavy metal and saying, well, how does this, like, do you think this helps your mood or does this put you in a worse mood? Because to me, any music could do, any type of music could put anybody in any mood, depending on their experiences with it, their history, how they relate to different genres. And, you know, his response was that he felt like it kind of validated something inside him, some darkness inside him. And interestingly, on his own, he eventually switched to jazz. So perhaps the music served its purpose for a while, and then he was ready to move on to something that is typically people think of as more upbeat and carefree. Yeah, so I talk to teenagers about their musical taste too, and I feel like somebody just needs to be kind of vigilant about how it's affecting them. You know, should they switch their listening? Should they keep it as is? I haven't had anyone in the context of music therapy request really dark music. Well, that might not be true. In general, I haven't, but it's overall, it's not, because we're not usually focused on just listening to music. It's usually more engaging than just sitting there listening for the clients that I've had.
I'm curious if rhythms also are affect people differently. So if you're with a particular age group of adults in a senior living with perhaps with Alzheimer's or some sort of dementia, are you noticing that they will resonate with familiar rhythms, or can you introduce African drumming? Can you introduce a Latin tune? How do you incorporate that in the movement that you're expressing with these people?
I mean, with the groups that I'm thinking about, they have done better with familiar music in the sense of they appear happier and more engaged with familiar music. I could introduce more on familiar music, but I tend to only have an hour every other week with some of these folks. And I really want to focus on bringing them joy in the moment rather than like teaching them to learn new to appreciate right. other music in that instance. Yeah.
Yeah, I could see that. But with little kids, now you are working with kids on the autism spectrum. Tell me what that's about. If they're not verbal, or what are the age groups that you're seeing these days?
So I have, let's see, at one school, it's probably 5 to 7 years old. And then I'm with middle schoolers at a couple of other schools. So I think like 11, 12, 13.
So are you noticing, I'm really interested in the rhythm versus melody, or obviously they go together, but are you noticing for the little ones that they can get the rhythm happening, or they need, and that maybe the older ones need more melody? I'm just curious, or maybe I'm off base totally.
Because within these groups, within the schools, there's so much variation of cognitive abilities, behavioral tendencies, even within these classrooms, that I couldn't compare ages, because it's not, the level of cognitive ability is not necessarily correlated to the age of the child. So now I'm forgetting the original.
Well, about rhythm and melody, if different levels of disability respond more to rhythm or more to melody, or is that not even relevant?
No, I don't find that. I do find that sometimes it can be surprising how, like, there's a 6-year-old I work with who I just found out that I can play a complex, relatively complex rhythm on drum, and he can imitate it. Not only can he imitate it, he can dance around the room with his own drum and still imitate what I'm doing. Now, I will have to say that many staff members cannot imitate a simple clap on a beat. So, you know, it's always like very heartening for me to find someone who is really drawn to rhythm or melody and can just jump in like that.
Well,
it doesn't seem to, you know, I know there is a certain type of autism where the people can be very, you know, highly musically inclined. I don't think I have any clients in that category, but I guess just like with, you know, neurotypical people, all the children have different levels of like ability to play music or relate to it or follow instructions or pay attention long enough to learn a pattern, things like that.
So when you get it in your body, isn't that, you talked about movement being so important. It is kind of an integration, right? Between the autonomic nervous system and also our physical movement. And are you just letting the kids, for instance, are they just doing their own thing? They're just dancing to the music? Like,
no, usually occasionally we do that. Occasionally we'll do a like imitating each other's dance moves type thing. But generally it's a little more structured, like the Hokey Pokey, or maybe a song I've just made up that involves shakers and putting them in different, you know, up, down, side, switch shakers with your partner, you know. So usually it's within a more structured setting. I have a couple middle schoolers where it's a little more free form, you know, like, yeah, dance any way you want to this music. Okay, we're going to imitate you. All right, now imitate us, you know. Now,
Right. And because, as we said earlier, that music really deals with the entire brain, and you were saying there are different centers of rhythm and music and motor sensory, that we are integrating, you're integrating, and in a therapeutic way. That's a really lovely image. If you have just joined us, this is the Healthy Options program on WERU Community Radio. I'm Rhonda Feynman. We're here with Heather Ellsworth, music therapist, musician, singer, and composer. Can you give us information about what a neurologic music therapist is? Is that a more of a specialty than a music therapist? What does that mean?
It is. And I'm going to read this definition from the Neurologic Music Therapy website, because I think there are a lot of overlaps too. But here's the quote. Well, actually, this is from the Burke Rehabilitation Hospital in New York, which uses neurologic music therapy. So, Neurologic music therapy differs from traditional music therapy as it views music not as a social science model for well-being, but as a neuroscience model where music is a hardwired brain language. Neurologic music therapy is the therapeutic application of music to address cognitive, sensory, and motor dysfunction due to neurologic disease or injury. So there are overlaps for sure, but there in neurologic music therapy, there are trademarked interventions that are used to achieve different outcomes. It's more based on the goal than on, say, do this for, instead of saying like, we're going to use these music interventions to work with a child with autism. It might be, you know, this intervention is good for people with aphasia, whether the aphasia is part of, is a result of a stroke or, you know, a developmental disability or whatnot. So that, I'm going to go with that definition because I think it does involve more learning about science. And I believe there's, they focus a bit more on research than traditional music therapy. And there are so many overlaps.
So when they're talking about somatic and functional, are they saying, does it mean that there are particular keys that are musical keys that we use, or is it a different technique? Or if somebody has aphasia, and we know that Mozart's piano concerto is has shown you know, for two pianos, that is really helpful for those people.
No, it's not that. I think because we're all so unique, it's not that individualized about what type of music or what speed of rhythm or anything. It's less specific than that, because you really have to go based on each person and where they're at and what their needs are and their preferences.
So it sounds like then on the neurological level, like somebody who's coming, recovering from a stroke, you're introducing things or just reminding them, perhaps they were musical or not, of a way of integrating or creating what you were saying, neuroplasticity, of creating new ways of having the brain make new connections. Would you say that that's neurological, or are you doing that with regular music therapy too?
That's a good question. It, you know, regular music therapy is going to tap into neurology. So, yeah, I mean, it's a program that you go through a neurologic music therapy training, and then you can be called a neurologic music therapist. So it's a specific training that you take with trademarked interventions.
Well, and they're specific. Are they? I'm just trying to understand this. So they're specific in a way that's different. How would that look?
I would say, I'm not sure sometimes what the difference is between the interventions I've read, like say for aphasia, what you can do to help someone with aphasia using melodies. It can be called something within that intervention, be called a specific acronym, which I don't know off the top of my head, but within neurologic music therapy, but that same thing can essentially exist within music therapy, maybe be not quite be called that or be explained a bit differently.
Well, I'm interested in this because if people are listening and you don't have to have a brain injury or a diagnosis of a particular dementia or autism or whatever, that I'm interested if it gets back to that melody rhythm. It sounds like if you're dealing with aphasia, is there a part of the brain that we want to exercise, you know, or find ways around that might, you were saying, it's a melody. It doesn't matter which song it is, but there is a way that we're practicing a particular technique for you because you have aphasia from a stroke, for instance, or... Yeah. Or somebody else has a gait problem from some other kind of injury and such. So we will work on this other kind of part of the brain that will be, we would do through melody, do through rhythm, and that can help, again, create more pathways in created to help overcome some of those limitations.
Yeah, so for like aphasia, I have a relative who had a stroke a few months ago, and I haven't been around him enough to use a lot of music therapy. And at first, he didn't have the cognitive capacity to, it wasn't helpful at first. But as he progressed, there was a time when, and this is a neurologic music therapy technique, and probably a regular music therapy technique as well, to turn the, say he was able to say, oh, let's see, say there's a sentence, I like dogs, right? And he could get to the I like, and then that's it. Changing sentences into melodies can be helpful. So like, I like dogs. And once he practiced that, then he could do it. So the brain is doing something there, and melody can be helpful. And along with the rhythm, you can say, I like dogs. And that emphasis of the beat on each word or each syllable, depending on what you're doing, can also be helpful.
So people can sing perhaps when they can't talk.
Yeah.
Let's all take that in for a moment. So we should sing more and talk less. I don't know. That's an extrapolation that I'm sorry. That's a total, really. You didn't say that. I'm saying that.
But maybe we'd be kinder.
Maybe. So by singing, and that is part of, quote, the literature, that because music was with the whole brain, that it's, if you have an injury in the speech area, but you can still sing and you can still speak your sentences, sing your sentences, you can communicate. And that must also be quite a relief for your relative and for other people in that situation.
Yeah, wow. I think it's a long road. I mean, this was like a one-off session. So I haven't had any regular ongoing, but I know that plenty of people have had music therapy for that purpose, and it's helpful. I do wish music therapy was part of more like rehabilitation programs, especially, but even just covered. We're not on health insurance in Maine. Some states do cover music therapy. So hopefully someday.
So this isn't covered by Medicare or Medicaid or?
No.
Really?
In some cases, I've been able to, like, I am called a professional vendor with the state of Maine. So there's a certain amount of money allocated to each professional vendor every year. And that goes, that I work through, what is it called? Kind of like a support services for people with developmental disabilities who are living with support staff, like adults. And so that can go towards music therapy. It's a certain amount. And when it runs out, then there's no more funding each year. But yeah, it's definitely not the same as being able to access it through, you know, your medical care, your health insurance.
Or through a physical therapist, or because that would be covered. So you mentioned Burke Rehabilitation Center, very famous, very, very state-of-the-art rehabilitation center in New York City. And I know that they're integrating this music therapy. I imagine they have people on staff. So somehow their music therapists and neurological therapists are being paid, and somehow they're working that out. Not sure if that's happening here in Maine. I know we have a good rehab center down in Scarborough. I've seen people do very, very well in some of those settings, but you're saying that's not necessarily the case.
Well, I'm aware of it's either two or three since I moved here. Well, since I became a music therapist in 2018, I've been aware of three full-time music therapy positions. Most of us are just contracting with different facilities and working with families individually. And it's a very different way of you just kind of surviving than having a regular job. So that's the way Maine is. Of course, not all states are in some states, you just go and you have a music therapy job, just like other people have a, you know.
an occupational therapist or right. Or an accountant. Okay, yes. Yeah. Accountant, music therapy, everybody. Yeah. Yeah, it's all one of this, really. All accountants need music therapy. All music therapy people need accountants. So it all works out.
Well, yeah, here we end up being, if we're contractors, we end up doing everything ourselves. So that's one thing. You have to like it all.
Or at there least you go. So when you're going in with the kids, the little ones, for instance, and I always think of kids as of really starting, you know, not necessarily on the autistic scale or whatever, but kids, they're always getting up and dancing, the little ones, and they're moving, the music comes on and they're dancing.
Yeah.
Some of them, but some of them don't, for whatever reason. How do you approach that? How would you, you know, here you are, this little one needs some music therapy. Heather, meet, you know, how do you begin? What do you do?
Well, the dancing, spontaneous dancing, I've seen that more with my, I used to do music enrichment with much smaller, like ages 2, 3, you know, and the thinking at the center I worked at the time and my own thinking was just, kind of just let the kid be. Like, if the kid doesn't want to dance, sometimes the parents would be trying to engage them. And I understood the philosophy of that place and just of, you know, just let them find their way, let them ease into it. Don't force them. They'll do it if and when they want to, you know.
But by listening, by taking it in, something is happening. Whether they're dancing, there's still things shifting, would you say, just by listening, by having some sort of interaction in that way?
Yeah, sure. And with those groups too, part of it was just to, you know, socialize with other kids. So they were doing that. Yeah, they were getting access to music. So
that's a good point about doing in community, a singing circle, a drum circle. Are you noticing if you were working with some of your patients one-on-one, would it be would they respond differently, or if you're noticing response differently than if they're in a group, as you said, watching other people sing? What are you noticing about that community aspect of the therapy?
Well, it can work both ways. I mean, the first example that comes to mind is I was working with a group of kids at a school, elementary age kids at a school with behavioral issues. And one of the children was kind of consistently derailing the rest of the group, and it wasn't working very well. And then when I worked with him one-on-one, it was fine. So that was back, but that didn't quite, I wouldn't say that was about the music. I think he just needed a less stimulating environment overall.
Right.
Yeah. And in terms of, I don't think I've had other situations where an individual client then became part of a group situation to compare. I think your question was about whether people are more, I don't know whether they do better in individual or group settings.
Well, do you notice changes? You know, some people respond in some way individually. And this child, you said, too stimulating to be with other kids. And,
right.
But for some, we could do something. But then in a group, they blossom or are able to participate more.
Yeah. Yeah. And in group, say at the assisted living, one of the assisted living centers that I work at, I see them helping each other out, which is really sweet because maybe they, you know, instead of being in their individual rooms, they're there in a group and they can see that they're cared for, you know, and that they can care for each other. So that's another benefit. But there are situations where I think one-on-one would be a lot better. I do work with one man individually who has dementia, and I don't think we've developed a relationship that started when his cognitive abilities were higher, and he's familiar with me now and comfortable, it seems. And I think that in that case, I'm not so sure how well he would do with a bunch of people that he wasn't familiar with, like in a group setting. I think also he was a musician. He is a musician. So he has a level of ability to drum along with things that other people in that situation might not be. And that might get frustrating if he's able to keep the beat and imitate me and other people are just off doing their own thing. So I just think it depends on where people are at, what their goals are, what their needs are.
Yeah. You're listening to Healthy Options. If you just joined us, that is what you're listening to right here on WERU Community Radio. I'm Rhonda Feynman. Our guest today is Heather Ellsworth, music therapist, neurologic music therapist, musician, singer, and composer. Well, I think it's a perfect time to be practicing some of what you've been telling us. And I brought my trusty bongos.
Okay.
I also have other things, but we are singers around here. Oh, I have a drum like that. Should I do a drum like that instead?
Sure. Or?
Oh, okay. Well, okay. We're doing a frame drum? What do we call that? What do you have here?
Well, you know, I have been calling it buffalo drum, but I recently learned that it has to be buffalo high to be buffalo drum. So now I have, honestly, I'm not sure. It was a gift. So.
But this is a frame, yeah, a drum that is on hide, and this was the one I have. The one you have seems to be painted, and mine has a beautiful fox on it. So here we are. Here.
Okay.
This is exciting. I love it.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Let's hum. Okay.
Let's hum, yes. So we'll be imitating rhythms, and the reason I might be doing this to increase someone's focus, you know, their ability to pay attention. Sometimes it might be a redirection. Like if you go into like classrooms in school, especially younger classrooms, you might notice teachers bring in tune in and imitate. And also most people like to be right. So they like to be able to successfully imitate a rhythm. And that I think also keeps them engaged. So I would start simple. So I might just start with, can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
You heard the drum. Okay.
I did.
Okay.
Do not do this, by the way, if you're driving. Well, I guess you could tap your steering wheel, but pay attention to the road.
And then I might say, and now listen to which hits are hard and which are soft.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. Yeah. Oh, let's do more. What else? Okay. Now let's sing. Okay. Okay. Just getting all excited here. Let's do more. Let's do a few more just to get that sense. Would you do, now I feel like we should get up and dance. I feel like moving. Doesn't everybody, if you're just joining us at home, we're talking with and doing some experiential music therapy with Heather Ellsworth, who is a music therapist, musician, singer, and composer. Yeah. Oh, let's do a few more just to get people. All right. Get people in. We're just warming up.
Okay.
Now,
go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, if you've just tuned in and you're hearing the drum, you are at the right station. This is WERU, and this is Healthy Options. We're doing music therapy on our drums today. I'm also, if you're at home and had trouble following, I think you could still feel okay about yourself. If this is not something you're accustomed to, it is a process.
Yes, exactly. And the, when I'm with a client, I will go up to their level. If they're great at drums, you know, I'll be doing complicated rhythms. If they're younger or you know, need more time, we'll just stick with simple rhythms. And it's something also that especially kids love doing it on chime bars. There are these colored, it's a glockenspiel with colored bars, and they can see, you know, I can say purple, red, orange. So they've got the verbal with the purple, the red, and the orange. And then also say, hey, you do some rhythms for me. And inevitably, they'll play 20 notes. And I'll say,
okay, nope, repeat that.
I have memory, you know, I have my own memory. Like, I've got my capacity here. Why don't we stick with six? And they'll try to sneak in 10. And I'll say, six.
Sounds anyway, like fun.
I don't know if you had mentioned a couple of interventions. We could do another one if we have time.
Yeah, we do. We have time.
So this is something I work with a man with. He's got some mental health issues. He has a brain injury. He's got some developmental disabilities. He's in his 70s and he loves Christmas songs. We've recorded a lot of Christmas songs, given them to his family for gifts. He also has, I have not seen this myself, but he has a tendency to scream at his staff helpers when he is upset. And so working on coping skills was one of the things his family wanted me to do with him. So we took the Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer song. The normal version would go, you know, Dasher and Dancer and Prancer and Vixen, Donder and Cupid.
And blah, blah, and Blitzen.
But do you recall the most famous reindeer of all? So what we did before we got into coping skills, I wanted him to list his strengths. So instead of, you know, Dasher and Dancer, it's I am. And if I was doing it with you, you would insert your strengths right there. And for him, I had a list of positive strengths, and he just selected from the list.
Such as
kindness, curiosity, joy, humor.
So you did that through the music he loved. I am kindness.
I am kind and... Yes.
Do a few more.
Well, I'm doing it for you.
No, we're all doing this. So everybody do this together. What are your strengths? We're going to put them in the Rudolph the Reindeer song. Come on, Heather, this is good. Do it to help us.
So say, I'll just say what he said then, because it's
That sounds good. That sounds good.
It ends up going, I am friendly and curious, adventurous and honest. And then he listed his supports, whose names I won't say, but say right. I'll make something like, I have Rhonda and Heather and Jacob and, you know, Blitz and whatever. So, and here's what I do when things aren't going my way. And then he listed, you know, the part that goes, da-da, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. It's like, he lists what he does. So I'm going to make something up. I take a walk around my house. I watch my favorite show. And that was accompanied with us printing out laminated pictures that represented those actions that were more positive than screaming at staff or throwing, you know. So that's a way to, like, because he has that melody, and this would apply to any intervention like this, in his head, it's easy to memorize the words he's written in that context, or if not memorize them, at least quickly recognize them and access them. And he can do that when I'm gone. He can do that in between sessions. He can listen to the song. He can probably recite parts of it from memory at this point and just have it more readily available, maybe than if somebody just said, so what are your coping skills, you know?
Absolutely. So, yeah. And so you're doing positive reinforcement. We're doing the singing that we've mm-hmm. been talking about for the last hour almost. And we are, for him, it's, you know, again, we were talking about what gets released when you're being positive. I think we mm-hmm. all know that if we're doing positive actions, what? Serotonin, dopamine, what? helping cortisol reduce all the stress hormones. So has it helped him? We don't know yet, or we're still in the process.
Well, this is an interesting thing. I still honestly will hear every time I'm there about staff conflicts he's been part of. So, you know, I've concluded that there's only so much I can do coming once a week. I've tried to encourage him to listen on his own, but there often seem to be technological issues around that. And
but what about the staff singing?
I know, but that's true. I do know one time he said to me, you know, I didn't yell today because of what we talked about last time. So he said that.
Yeah.
You know, I haven't done a survey of how frequently the yelling has happened. I think it is very difficult sometimes to change some of these behaviors, especially in a 70-year-old man.
Well, our brains are plastic. They can.
Right. But they are plastic.
But they are hurt.
He knows what they are. He knows what they are.
Yeah.
I think, yes, it would take a lot of, sometimes I think that with really like grooves that have been made in our brains, pathways that like habits that have gone on and on and on and on and on for years and years, that it would be good to have daily music therapy, you know.
Absolutely.
But that obviously is not feasible for most people. But just like meditate, but most of us, daily meditation is better than weekly meditation. Daily exercise is better than weekly exercise. So, but, you know, I do what I can in the time I have and hope that it makes a difference.
Well, I'm just thinking, what about, well, you know, people who aren't singers might get self-conscious, but wouldn't it be something if the staff would happily come in and sing with him or sing to him? It doesn't have to be a formal thing necessarily, not to take your place by any means, but to learn that the staff learn some other techniques to deal with some of these clients. Today we're going to change our clothes, Rudolph. How about taking a walk? Only would the staff have a better nervous system, maybe we're starting something new here. If you just tuned in, you are listening to Healthy Options here on WERU Community Radio. I'm Rhonda Feynman, and our guest today is Heather Ellsworth, music therapist, musician, singer, and composer. What is a musical intervention? A singing intervention?
Well, intervention is just the one word. There's different words people use, but intervention is one word to just say what you are doing within music therapy. This intervention is in order to increase attention, like that.
So you have an example.
So we were talking about singing, and I was just recalling that I was working with an adult with autism at one point, and he struggled to remember what he needed to do in terms of hygiene every day. So we wrote a song together about the order of operations in terms of like washing your body, brushing your teeth, eating breakfast, things like that.
So you wrote a song?
Yes. Oh. I am a songwriter.
Yes.
Naturally.
But I would love to hear the song. Yeah, I would love let's do it. Okay, well, we're saying this. Today we wash our hands. When we get up in the morning, we brush our teeth. Yes.
So I do it for myself in the morning in terms of, I'll be like, oh my gosh, I have to remember my notebook, my phone, and my sweatshirt. And I'll be walking around the house trying to get something else done, going, notebook, phone, sweatshirt, notebook, phone, sweatshirt. And then, you know, that's what helps me remember more than if I just said notebook, phone, sweatshirt.
That's really helpful. Everybody can do that. Everybody. You can start singing your to-do list.
Yes.
That's marvelous. Do you have one last story for us, and we can leave it there?
Well, I do have there was something I was thinking about many years ago when I lived in San Francisco. I was part of the Beta Breakers race, but I wasn't racing. I was one of the many people who dress in crazy costumes and just has fun and walks the, I think it's 7 miles from Beta Breakers. Well, we were all forest creatures in our crew, and I was not, it was a warm day. I had a very thin cotton shirt on, and most of us were not dressed warmly. We got to the Golden Gate Park with about a half hour left to walk, and it started pouring, and the temperatures dropped, and we were freezing, and there was no quick way out of where we were. And I was really starting to hurt. Like, by the time I got to the end of the race, I was physically shaking. I had to go to the Red Cross tent. It was so cold. But for the last mile or two, my friend was also a singer. We just started singing songs, and that is what got us through, because there was something to concentrate on other than the suffering. You know, it was positive. I feel like, so I guess the point is just like, yeah, music can get us through pain, all sorts of pain, and it can redirect us and bring us into joy. And
so, what were you singing? Anything in particular? We're not cold. We're really comfortable. There's like, it's not raining now.
All right. Raindrops keep falling on my head. No, I don't actually know. We were part of like a 3-women a cappella group at the time, but I don't remember what we were singing.
Well, everybody can take this with them and notice how you can incorporate singing. I'm chopping the garlic. I'm going to saute this. Honey, pass the honey. Well, I think we have to leave it there. Everybody be singing now. Our guest today, thank you for joining us. Our guest today on Healthy Options has been Heather Ellsworth, musician, singer, composer, and music therapist. Thank you, Heather, for being with us today. We appreciate your speaking with us on Healthy Options and sharing the important work you've been doing in so many creative ways and reminding us to sing. Heather's website is MidcoastMusicTherapy.com. That's MidcoastMusicTherapy.com. And you can find the link to the show and other information that was mentioned in the public affairs section and the Healthy Options archives at WERU.org. You can also get the WERU app and listen to our Healthy Options podcast. Thanks, Joel Mann, Amy Brown for WBRU engineering support, Peter Hall for co-productions, and as always, always thank you to all of our WERU listeners and supporters. This is Rhonda Feynman wishing you the best in health.